ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Laura Bell Spirovsky grew up in Manila in a communal apartment block with a big square courtyard in the middle. That's where all the women in her building would congregate, her mum, her aunts, cousins, and her grandma, while little Laura Bell, an introverted and creative kid, would retreat into her imagination whenever she could. One notable absence from this bustling matriarchal home was Laura Bell's dad. He was in Australia, working as a taxi driver, sending money back to his wife and his young daughter, whom he'd never met in person. So when Laura Bell imagined her father, she saw him as Santa Claus, a man who sent presents and lived in a mysterious place far away. Eventually, the family reunited and Laura Bell and her mum moved to Australia. Here, Laura Bell became a celebrated artist, a three-time finalist in the Archibald. She fell in love and her career was soaring until an injury forced her to stop painting and ask some big questions about who she was and what her life was all about. Laura Bell has now written a book drawing on her experiences. It's called White Hibiscus. Hi, Laura Bell.
Hi, Sarah.
You come from such an interesting family background, or an unusual one. As I say, your mum is Filipino. What
Yes.
kind of world did she grow up in? What stories has she told you about her childhood?
Well, it's funny because my mum isn't the most sentimental person, I suppose. So she doesn't really hold on to very much. I think that's one of her secrets to aging gracefully, to be honest. But she, I mean, it's all little scraps of visual imagery, I think. A lot of it is climbing coconut trees. She was a great climber when she was a child. She lived in a tiny island called Catanduanes, and her parents had a large house there. And she grew up with her eight siblings, and they ran a small general store when she was a child. And so she would have a lot of stories about that little store and kind of, you know, wrapping the peanut brittle and the little, you know, candies and things. And it's so funny. One of the things that I remember most, weirdly, is they would have a few different brands of toothpaste. So they were a general store, like everyone will buy everything there. And the neighbors will be like, oh, can I get the Colgate? And my mom will be like, which one? And they'll pick like a different brand because Colgate became like a catch-all term
the name
for toothpaste.
Toothpaste.
Yeah. Like they almost didn't know that it was toothpaste. They just called it a Colgate, if that makes sense.
What place did music have in her childhood?
A huge one. Filipinos, I think, are pretty well known around the world for being a very musical culture. And my mum's family was no different. She was a singer. She sang ever since she was out of the womb, I'm pretty sure. And all of her siblings were very musical. So the house was constantly full of singing and guitar playing and drumming on random bits of furniture.
Would that have been Filipino music or American pop songs? What would she have been listening to?
A little bit of everything. She actually ended up working at a radio station in her late teens. And it was a little bit of everything. She loved, you know, Nat King Cole, and Freddie Aguilar was a huge Filipino star at the time. A lot of kind of 70s folk music was big at the time, and disco, of course.
This is a great banquet of musical influences.
Absolutely.
How did her love of music take her beyond the Philippines, take her overseas?
It's actually extraordinary because if she was my child and she told me what she told her parents back then, I'd be like, no, don't go. Because she essentially just saw an ad in the newspaper saying, can you sing? Do you dream of travel? And she's like, yeah, to both. Absolutely. And she just responds and apparently auditions for some people. And they're like, we know exactly where to put you. We have two other Filipino women. We'll put you in a band. We'll fly you off to Japan. I think the whole thing happened within a month or two.
And yeah, to hear that sounds like there are so many potential risks, that could have gone wrong. But what happened for your mum? Was it a legitimate ad?
It was legitimate, and it was her dream job. Like, she essentially went from student, working at a radio station, and then jet-setting across Asia to sort of Japan, Singapore, Malaysia, and just singing in five-star hotels.
She ended up singing in a hotel bar in Malaysia. And who joined her there? Who were her bandmates?
So by that time, it was her younger sisters, Grace and Amor. And obviously, they're also amazing singers. They also played different instruments. I think one had a keyboard, two of them had guitars, I think. And it was a bit like a Supremes kind of thing with a bit of a Fleetwood Mac, but really cool 80s makeup.
Well, what did they look like? Have you seen pictures from this
period? Oh, yes. Amazing. I mean, my mom's style was on point. You know, she actually studied, let me get it right, cosmetology. So like makeup, studied makeup in college at some point. I don't know where she managed to fit that in with her jet setting lifestyle, but yeah, she just looked incredible. Like the color combinations. I mean, oh my gosh.
And this is where your mom met your dad for the first time. What was he doing in Malaysia?
So my dad was working for Energo Project, which is a former Yugoslav engineering firm. And he was essentially traveling all around the world, really, as an engineer. He loved working particularly in the Middle East and in South America. And at the time, they were building a bridge in Malaysia. And he just happened to be staying at the hotel where my mum was performing with her sisters.
And what kind of impression did he make on your mum? What did she think of this European stranger in the bar?
Well, of course, they're used to plenty of attention. I think at the time she actually had this Japanese boyfriend even, or a Chinese boyfriend. And my mum had many suitors and admirers. But I think the thing that really caught her attention, all three sisters really, was that my dad was going to the bar, but he was always ordering a soda water. He's always been a teetotaler. So I think they were really impressed by that, almost like his self-control. He was dressed really well. My dad looked like one of the members of the Bee Gees. So you can sort of imagine like a denim on denim with like a curly hair situation. It was amazing. He was owning it.
Really, he was rocking his own style is what I'm hearing very strongly. And so did things develop between them quickly or what was the story?
Well, this is the funny thing. And I feel like this is a very Filipino thing, especially of that generation, where they kind of, it's almost like their personalities become displaced. And they kind of share this communal identity in a way. And they were very close as sisters and very spiritual. So that I think that helps as well. But they were kind of like, we like this guy. If he likes any one of us, go with him. Like that is essentially your ticket out of the Philippines, you know, out of a small island. He will show you something different. He will show you something more dynamic. But that's what they were thinking. But my dad, according to him at least, saw my mum and only had eyes for her. So within 2 years' time, my mum was flying to Belgrade, meeting his family, and then pretty quickly getting married within that two-year period.
How did your mum impress your dad's parents?
This is my dad's, one of his favourite stories. So my grandfather, my dad's dad, loved spicy food, which is, I think, strange for a Serbian Macedonian man. But he had this, I don't know if it was like a test, but he had a plate of raw chilies next to a smaller plate of salt. And I picture it as almost like a Godfather kind of scene where he's just looking my mum in the eye, dipping the chili and like not breaking eye contact and putting it in his mouth and kind of like, you know, over to you, what's your move? And my mum apparently just does exactly the same thing. Mind you, they don't speak the same language. So there's all this nonverbal communication going on. But yeah, my mum just eats like one, two, three. And apparently my grandfather gets up, hugs her and is like, this is my daughter.
Imagine that, you know, a Filipina would have a pretty strong strong palate when it came to spicy food. Like, this is not someone to take on.
Exactly. I could imagine her rolling up her metaphorical sleeves and just being like, step aside,
boys. You call
that
a chili? Here it comes.
Exactly.
So she got the approval from her beau's dad. Then the two of them stayed in Europe together. How did they spend their time there?
They stayed for about a year and then she got pregnant, and the intention was to have me there and basically just live out life there and travel all around Europe. But then pretty quickly, war started to break out in the region. And so my dad essentially applied for jobs anywhere else in the world, as far away as possible.
This was the civil war in Yugoslavia was
that's
happening
right.
at this period.
That's right.
Right.
I think he got a job in South Africa and in Australia. So the only reason he chose Australia was the friend who gave him the job promised him that he would build bridges, and building bridges was his favorite thing in the world. So that's the only reason Australia was chosen.
So that's what he was promised. What did he end up doing for work once he arrived in Australia?
Well, as with all kind of under the table deals, it wasn't exactly as he had hoped. He kind of fell out with that friend and tried another job. And because his English wasn't great, he was relying heavily on the former Yugoslav community, essentially the diaspora that did the same thing that he did, like just fled to as far away as possible to save their lives. And I think when you get a lot of desperate people who are just struggling to survive, and you end up being taken advantage of sometimes. So I think that's what he faced. And all the while, my mum ended up going to the Philippines to give birth to me because my dad figured, you have family there, you know, you at least will have some support. And visa became really the biggest struggle over the next few years.
So your dad was in Australia making money to send
yes.
home, and you were born in the Philippines, and this
yes.
was home for you as a little girl.
Yes.
Tell me about this home in Manila. What did it look like? What do you remember?
So we lived in a few different places. As I mentioned, my grandparents' place in Catanduanes, and we lived in a couple of places in Manila itself. But the one I remember most is, as you said, the one with this concrete courtyard. I don't know why the imagery of that courtyard sits so strongly in my mind. I can't find an equivalent layout in Australia. It was kind of like little townhouses, really little, with these courtyards in the middle. And I think there were several rows of them. But it ended up creating a tiny community because you sort of had ready-made best friends living around you. And after school, we would just play together on this courtyard.
And you had extended family living there as well?
I think in the Philippines, the situation is family will just dip in and out of each other's lives. Like everyone's place is everyone else's place. You know, you're always welcome to come and stay for a night or two. And we often went to stay at other family members' houses. So home was a very nebulous construct for me because it wasn't really tethered to a specific place. And I feel like that's something I carried into Australia as well.
So your dad was helping support the family financially. What about your mum? Was she still singing, or was she taking care of you full time?
So one of the greatest gifts I think that my dad gave us is that he worked solely to support not just us, but also his aging parents in Serbia. And so my mom could afford to just stay home with me and really offer me a safety that was compromised by other things, by just the sort of uncertainty of living in the Philippines. It's so crowded, especially in Manila. I think Manila is very different from the rest of the Philippines. You know, it's not like there's no island time in Manila. It's very loud and very busy. So the fact that my mum was always there really was the thing that held me together, I think, as a child.
When you were still just a little girl, your mum noticed that you weren't eating much. Where did she take you to try and work out what was going on and help?
She took me to something called a manghihilot, which is I'm not going to say witch doctor, but it lives in a similar headspace.
A shaman
to,
or a healer.
Yeah,
a healer.
Exactly. And he used different herbal kind of, he would put the herbs on the skin and then he'd put like a banana leaf to like press it down, like a compress. And I remember the smell of the place and weirdly just the image of like a wad of pre-cut banana leaves that looked like cash on his table. For some reason, that's one of the strongest images for me.
How did you feel about going there? What do you remember the experience being like?
Scary, really scary, because this was back in my grandparents' village. So, you know, there was no paved road. We're talking nipa huts, so like little huts on stilts. And so I remember like climbing up the bamboo ladder up to the house, and this really strong image of the Mangihilot's very old mother. And she smiles at us and her teeth are red because she's chewing the betel leaf, which everyone does over there. My mum too. And there was barely any light inside this hut. Everything was shrouded in darkness, and you get all of these herbal smells and of course the feeling of having to remove your clothes in front of a stranger. I mean, I was like 5 at this time, so I was still very young, but just the feeling of exposure. And I think because the Philippines is such a hot country, anytime I would feel cold, I'd really remember that. So that was one of my first memories of feeling cold, was in that man's hut.
Did it help?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I think it helped my mum. I think it helped to ease her her feeling of not being able to control the situation. I think she thought she was doing something about it. Not that she really understood what was going on. I certainly didn't understand what was going on. But now that I am looking back on my childhood, I really had terrible anxiety. It was just panic attacks. I think I was suffering from panic attacks as a child.
Was art, creativity, imagination, were they places that you could go as a kind of refuge in the midst of that anxiety, of those big feelings you were having as a little kid?
Interestingly, in the Philippines, I didn't make art as much as when I came to Australia, partly because we didn't have many materials or toys. So the closest I came to creative play was Play-Doh. That was the only art I remember making as a child. And I had a cousin who was pretty good at drawing, but then the moment he showed me that he was good at drawing, it was like, oh no, that's his thing. I can't go into that territory because that he already knows how to do that. I won't be as good as him. So I immediately like cut that off as a potential creative activity for me. And I stuck to Play-Doh because I knew that I could do that well. And mind you, the Play-Doh sculptures were like really good.
Play-Doh is nothing to be sniffed at. Play-Doh is one of the great materials and underrepresented in our art galleries, I think. I love
absolutely,
Play-Doh.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, one thing that you did have an experience with as a child, I guess it's a creative pursuit in a sense, is beauty pageants, which
yes,
are a big thing here in the Philippines.
Oh my goodness. Like, you have no idea how big beauty pageants are.
And for kids as well.
Yes, yes. So the pageant that I entered was called Little Miss Philippines. I'm pretty sure it still runs now, but we are talking nationwide, televised. I mean, everyone was watching this show. It was really like reality TV before reality TV.
And whose idea was it for you to take part?
So I was about 4 years old when the idea started playing around between my mum and her sisters. And I think they would, because we would watch it, of course, on our little black and white TV. And my mum would look at me and look at her sisters and be like, she could totally do this. You know, she's cute. She can sing. She's smart. I think we should give it a try. And kudos to my mom. She went in with the purest intentions and just, she wasn't a pageant mom in the way that we look at sort of American versions of child beauty pageants. So even when I look at photographs of myself back then, I looked like a child. You know, I looked like a child in a little dress, as opposed to some of the other, especially wealthier contestants who kind of were really dolled up in that very extravagant makeup and hair. And like, you could tell I had less money than them because my hair wasn't done and my dress, you could see my feet. Like, it wasn't long enough to cover my feet.
And did you have to do a performance as part of that?
Yes. And I have such clear memories of her teaching me this song that I was going to perform with like the hand movements and everything. So like, I would have a hairbrush for a microphone and she would model for me how I was going to hold my hands and like look up and like look down and all this stuff.
Well, of course, and she had all that experience, I guess,
exactly,
performing.
Exactly. So totally built in. And I remember she introduced it as a sort of game. Like, she didn't even tell me what it was for. She's like, let's just try this thing. You know, I'm going to do this. Can you copy that? And so by the time we arrived at the studio to actually record the first episode that I was on, because I think I was on like 5 episodes in total, I was like, yeah, this is fine. This is easy. I even like voted to go first. I was not anxious at that point yet. And there's a video of me with this little like turntable, almost like a lazy Susan for children. And I would stand there with my escort. That's what they called it, my escort, who was just my cousin, dressed in his traditional barong. And me in this little dress where you can see my little feet. And we turn around and the guy was just like, you just have to wave. Just keep waving. I'm like, all right. And I waved and the lazy Susan for children turned around and there was a studio audience. And I was like, oh my gosh, where did they come from? Because that wasn't like that during rehearsal. You know, I didn't know that people were going to sit in those things. And so I feel like that totally triggered my anxiety for the very first time.
Oh my goodness. Did you still sing when you were confronted with this room of people?
I did. I did still sing. And I mean, it wasn't my best performance. I will say that. It was pitchy and I couldn't hear myself as well because everything was echoing. I was slightly off because there was a delay in the music. It was chaos, but I did pull it off. And I won. I won that the first round that took me to the semifinals.
And how did it end up going? Am I talking to a little Miss Filipina here?
Well,
am I in the presence of royalty?
If you ask my relatives, and they still talk about it to this day, I should have won. I got second place, but they maintain, especially my uncle, he maintains that the winner was the niece of one of the judges who was very kind of high up socially. And he's like, look at, he probably has a whole file of like, look at their, you know, talent portions next to each other. Clearly Lauravel was the superior one. Hers was, you know what I mean?
I'm with your uncle. Yeah. Lauravel was robbed.
Don't worry, I'm playing the long game. I'm just going to try and win at life.
You can go back as Miss Senior. Surely
exactly.
There are prizes for all stages of life.
Oh my, totally, totally, exactly.
So after this excitement, Lauravel, you were living in Manila with your mum, with your aunts, your grandma was around, uncles, and what did you know about your father? I mean, your mum and dad were still together, even though he was in another country. What image did you have in your head or what ideas did you have about this man?
I had about three photographs that I could use as a reference point. And I remember thinking, I look more like that stranger than my mum. And that was very unsettling for me. And, you know, when phones, mobile phones first started, he sent us one. I think I was around, 6 or 7. And I heard his voice for the first time. And it was like a walkie-talkie quality, like really bad quality sound. But it's so strange what children understand, I think, because I knew that I had a father, even though I'd never met him. I thought of the concept of a father, that I came from someone and my mum, almost like a kind of, my mum plus something else equals me. Because I could tell that I was not a direct copy of her, you know, even though I tried to be very hard. But my dad was, he meant so many different things. He meant a promise of a better life. He meant a promise of peace, certainly, because Manila is not a peaceful place at all. And I was overwhelmed most of my childhood, I think. So much so that I'd often just sit at a corner like a creepy little possessed child that would just be like facing a corner because I was too overstimulated. But I guess I have memories of, because my mom is a very beautiful woman, a lot of male attention that she would receive would make me feel very threatened and very protective over her. Even though I, at the time, didn't really know what that meant, I think I just sensed that it was predatory towards her. And obviously I wanted to protect her because my mum, even though she was older than me and she was looking after me, I felt strangely maternal over her in a weird way because she's also quite a young person. Like she's very young at heart. I don't think she and I had a traditional mother-daughter relationship. We really were more like best friends who lived together, even when I was very young.
It's interesting. I mean, as you're describing it, there's this dynamic, a very close intimacy between you and your mum, but then there's this sort of ghostly presence of this other part of that triangle of your father, who is there in spirit, in reference, but not physically. You say that you had photos and there were conversations, and he sent you gifts. What sort of gifts would he send you?
So he would send me packages for my birthday, and they got larger and larger over the years. And my dad's brother is also a visual artist. He's a painter, still lives in Serbia in this incredible house in the mountains just by himself. And on my fifth birthday, he sent me a birthday card from his younger brother with a sketch of myself done from, I guess, a still of the Little Miss Philippines pageant that I had won the first round of. So I was wearing the same floral tiara, the same little gown, and my mum's one of the necklaces that my dad bought for her when they were dating. And I saw this drawing, which was done in color pencil, and it just blew my mind. I had never seen anything like it in my life. I really hadn't encountered art before, and just this idea of I could become the subject of an artwork was wild. And I think I didn't really know what to do with that information at the time.
You had this rich family life with your mum in Manila, and you know about this man, your dad, and you've got these kind of ideas in your head, connection with him. When did you actually meet your dad for the first time?
I was 7 years old when I met my dad for the first time. And obviously, he was only coming for a few months, however long the tourist visa was. But I distinctly remember that day at the airport. It was my first time going to the airport, and it was really busy and crowded. And I sort of knew and didn't know what we were doing there. I think the idea of finally meeting this man that I'd heard all of these myths and legends about was a really terrifying thing for me, because I was only used to loving him from a distance. And the idea of him taking physical form, I mean, for my child brain, like as if Jesus came down to earth, you know, it's a terrifying concept. And when he comes in, the first thing that I remember was my mum detaching herself from me, from my auntie who came with us, and just running into the crowd because she had seen him. And I heard her gasp just as she let go of my hand. And I never felt so lonely in my life as that moment, because it felt like I was handing a relay baton to someone else. Like, she had been mine. She had been my tether to the world, because I was such a dreamy sort of child. And the moment she let go of me and I watched her hug him almost like in slow motion in my mind, it was such a sad and painful abandonment. Because I'd never seen her be so physical with a man, first of all. And I'd had, you know, my heckles have been raised by every man at that point. And yet I knew that this one was okay. Like, this was the good one, you know, this one was the correct one. And then he saw me, and I kind of detached from myself at that point. And I remember that we hugged each other, but I wasn't really there. It was almost like an out-of-body experience. But I really remember his smell. And it was such a clear thought in my mind. He smelled just like me after I'd been playing outside. Like, we had the same BO.
Wow.
Which was crazy, because it was the part of me I didn't like. Like, I don't want to smell like BO. I want to smell clean like my mother.
And he was a white man, so he was a white person. So that must have been weird too, that you feel so intimately, physically connected with someone who looks so different from everybody else that you know.
Completely. And he had like really hairy arms, and I'm like, why is he so hairy? Why is his chest so hairy? Like, you're just suddenly recognizing men, because Filipino men are very different to European men. And I just had this massive identity crisis, I think, because I thought, if I'm half of him and half of her, and I really just want to be her, you know, how am I going to grapple with this?
A few years later, once your dad had permanent residency in Australia, he was able to bring you and your mum here. Where was home for you once you made it to Australia? What did life look like here? How did it compare to that bustling matriarchal compound in Manila?
Oh, it's chalk and cheese. Absolute chalk and cheese. So my dad was living in a little apartment in Croydon at the time. And he had this balcony that he stuffed chock-a-block full of plants. Like, I'm telling you, there was about a 30-centimeter gap that you could walk through to actually water the plants. But I had a little forest and a bedroom of my own for the very first time in my life, and a mattress. The climate was completely different. The air smelled incredible. My dad was bragging about the air, even in Manila. He's like, you just wait until you get to Sydney. The air smells amazing.
What have you cooked or fresh or what was special
just
about it?
Just clean. Just not pollution. Because especially in the 90s, Manila was extremely polluted. But Australia was the absolute opposite of that. The sky was bluer. I don't know why, but it's like the saturation was turned right up. There were trees everywhere, which was incredible. There was a lot to adjust to. There was a lot to wrap my head around. And I think I was just overwhelmed by how beautiful it was.
What about school? What sort of experience was that for you?
So I went first to Croydon Park Public School. I did year four there. And I was expecting to be bullied. It's so strange. I was like, okay, prepare yourself. I'd never been bullied before. I don't know where I even got the idea from. I'm pretty sure I saw it on some like Saved by the Bell episode. I was like, this is what's going to happen. There are a bunch of white kids. They're going to bully you. And it really wasn't that at all. It was pretty multicultural. I was the only Filipino there, but it was sort of like just a mix of everyone. And I think I just became a little nerd. I just was like, I was always just there for the teacher. I am such a teacher's pet and I love learning and I love being a model student because I guess they were like my surrogate mum and I wanted to make life easier for them.
And so you'd gone from having this dad that you spoke to now and again and got presents from to this real human man living in the house with you and your mum. What was that like? How did your relationship develop as you were spending this amount of time together?
I think strangely one of the things that helped was that my mum got pregnant pretty much immediately. And I don't know what it is, but I tethered my adjustment period, let's say, to my mum giving birth. The larger and larger her stomach got, like sort of like biding my time, that by the time this whatever, I guess a baby is going to come out, however that works, everything will be fine. I will be normal and we get to truly start fresh. It's almost like I was holding my breath until my brother was born. And the whole time, my dad, obviously as the sole provider at the time, he was barely home. He was a full-time taxi driver and he loved it. He absolutely loved taxi driving. He always loved driving in general. He was a bit of a rally driver in Serbia. And he basically felt like he was in control of his own destiny when he was behind the wheel. And as a result, I rarely ever saw him. You know, he would leave very early. He would come home very late. And his presence in my daily life, I would see his uniforms hanging as my mom ironed them. And eventually she would teach me how to iron them. And it was a strange, I actually get a bit emotional thinking about ironing my dad's uniform and his epaulets. Like he was the best dressed cabbie out there because he had the crispest uniform. He always smelled amazing. And my dad is a huge perfume fiend. But it was such an intimate thing where I would get to know the traces of him. Yes.
What about language? I mean, were you speaking English with one another?
Yes. So he, with the English that he had, we were able to communicate. And I had to get used to his accent, of course, which was completely different. And so I would learn to read his body language very well. And then when my brother was born, he decided to not speak English anymore. And to only speak Serbian or majority Serbian so that my brother would learn it.
What
really
did that
quickly.
Mean for you?
Well, it isolated me from him further. I felt even more that he was impenetrable. And my mum is phenomenally skilled with languages. Unfortunately, it skipped me. But she could speak Serbian. So they would speak in Serbian. And they would speak Serbian to my brother. And eventually my grandma, my dad's mom would come. They would all be speaking Serbian and I would just be alone. Again, felt really, really alone, sort of searching for some kind of umbilical cord to get back to the family.
What role did art come to have then as you were here now in Australia and becoming a teenager? You said you didn't have resources back in Manila, but you'd been really struck by the drawings you'd seen by your cousin and then by your uncle. When did you start making your own creations?
That is definitely one thing that my dad and I shared. So because his brother was also an artist, he was familiar with the idea of an artist and he perfectly accepted that as a thing, as a direction in life. And he picked up straight away that I had talent and he bought me books on artists. His friends would buy me books on artists. And I just built up this little personal library where I could look at different techniques and sort of teach myself slowly. And he was extremely encouraging. And I would have the hallowed spot on the refrigerator of my drawing being put up there. So that's one way that we were able to stay connected, because art transcended verbal language. And in a way, he was my first audience. You know, I was making art so that he would like it.
After school, you toyed with the idea of becoming an art teacher, but ended up devoting yourself to your own artistic practice and studied at the College of Fine Arts in Sydney, but really worked on your own wave of painting and are particularly known for portraiture. And one of the subjects that you often paint again and again is the concert pianist Simon Tedeschi, who's also your husband, so that makes it convenient, I guess, to paint someone.
Mm-hmm. The first portrait I ever did of him was March in 2017, and I tried to enter that into the Archibald, and that didn't get in. But that was the first of many, many, many portraits of Simon, and one of the most generous things about him is that he does not care how I portray him. He's not vain like that. And so that creative freedom, that creative license that he's given me has truly been the crucial thing to take my art to where it currently is.
Tell me about your proposal or his proposal to you, Laura Bell. How did that play out?
It's such a funny story. So neither of us are very sporty. Simon, who loves cricket, actually, never got into sports because, of course, his hands were these precious objects, right? Totally not right, by the way. He's extremely into deadlifting and heavy weights. So pianists out there, go for it. But one day he said, hey, I booked us kayaking. I was like, okay. Now, the only times I've been kayaking was in a river. A stream even. We're not talking like rapids. We're talking really calm, straight waters, no waves. It was a very wavy day. And I'd only ever ridden a kayak as like a one-person kayak, but he got a two-person kayak. I was in the front. He was in the back. I was on day one of my period. Let that be known.
This is a perfect storm scenario.
Indeed, it was getting stormy. The weather was not helpful at all and was strangely like a pathetic fallacy of my own internal turbulence. I was just really not on that day. And so he's like, okay, showing me this little map, like, let's go to this little beach over here. So we're going. And again, I'm not used to being in a two-person canoe or whatever kayak that we were in. Nor was he. I think this was his first time. And it was really like the official end of the honeymoon period that day because I was just not having it. I was like, he was like, why don't you just go evenly, you know, even strokes? Why do you keep going one direction over another? I'm like, do you want us to go in circles? Can you see that there are waves? Anyway, you can imagine how the conversation went. But he kept telling me to go to this one little beach. And I was like, no, we're closer to that one. Any beach matters. Like, can we just get out of here? And his voice changes. And he uses my first name, like my full name, which is always, as we know, a thing.
A sign.
Laura Bell, let's go to that beach. I'm like, okay, all right. So we go, we get out, and he is laughing. And he runs over. And I'm like, what's going on? And I can see written in little bamboo sticks, it says, "Marry me, Lauribel." And I literally fell on my knees, which happens apparently. And he comes and he helps me up. And then he goes back down and he goes on one knee and he shows me the ring. And I just kind of black out, I think, for the rest of the time, because it came out of nowhere. I did say yes, obviously, but yeah, it worked out.
Did you have to get back on your kayaks at the end of this?
We really did. Oh my gosh. But that was all the
mood had changed.
The mood had changed.
Well, I'm glad though that it came off the way that it did. And at that point, so you have this beautiful love story and your career, your painting career is going great guns. You're a three-time finalist in the Archibald, exhibiting in lots of places. And then in 2021, you had to put down your brush. What happened?
What happened is a very complex story. Still, I don't know the full story of how it began, but I had been doing what people in their mid to late 20s do and just go for it career-wise. I just put absolutely everything, every ounce of energy, every second of my day was geared towards making work, exhibiting work, selling work. I was just on this downward, really fast slope, and I was burning out, and I'd burnt out again and again and again. And the burnout accumulates and it becomes a creative block. And you just keep working. You're like, if I keep chiseling away, this block is going to dissipate and I will get through it and we'll get back on track. And it feels like you're just this locomotive that is running out of steam. So I was completely overworked. And at the same time, ironically, to strengthen my posture, everyone did that, like, COVID, like, getting fit regime, right? We either did that or the opposite. I did the get fit routine. And as I did with my work, I overdid it with that too. So it was a combination of repetitive strain from working, from painting, and just going ballistic at the gym. And it started out as muscular strain. And I thought, whatever, I'll just, you know, use one of these spiky balls and you know, tenderize the crap out of myself, because I really was treating myself like a piece of meat. Like I had very little respect for my physical well-being. I was just using it as a tool. I was using it as a vehicle to get me where I needed to go. So there was very little self-love at the time. And then what really tipped the scales was one night in early September, I woke up and my arm was on fire. It was like the worst pins and needles. It was like my arm wasn't there. It was just completely numb. And I panicked, obviously, and it happened every single night for a few weeks. And I basically spent the next 3 years going to every specialist imaginable, every physio I could get my hands on, you know, rheumatologists, spinal surgeons, everyone, new personal trainers. I went through so many personal trainers just trying to find someone who can help me. And all the while, the desperation is just escalating because I didn't know who I was outside of the workhorse that I had become.
And were you still trying to paint at the same time that your body was doing this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I didn't know what taking a break meant because, frankly, I thought I was just going to lose myself if I didn't work. And that was one of the things that I learned from my dad, really. My dad is the biggest workhorse I know. And the thing that he did that proved to us how much he loved us was work. So if I kept working, that means I could support my family. And if I could keep working and support my family, that means he could stop working. So really, I was trying to dethrone my dad as my family's breadwinner. I wanted him to stop. So in a way, it was me trying to show love to him. But I just had to figure out what slowing down meant. I had to figure out what taking a break meant because I was the type who simply couldn't have a holiday. I didn't even know what weekends were.
Was there also fear for you around who you would be if you weren't this successful painter that you were creating? Like, was it deeper than just earning an income, but kind of around an identity of who is Laura Bell if she's not creating these portraits?
Completely. And that was really the hardest thing to shift is who am I? Who actually am I outside of this? Outside of the only thing at the time that I thought I was contributing that was good in the world. And funnily, you know, you mentioned success. I didn't think about myself as successful at all. In fact, the idea of success was terrifying because it meant pressure, you know, imposter syndrome. I still suffer from it, much, much less so now. But when your job, when everything about your job is made up, and yes, everything is made up, but my job is really made up, you know what I mean? Like, everything is just decided by a whim, you know, what do I feel like doing today? And that doesn't sit right with me because I like structure, I like stability, I like predictability, I like control. And art does not do well with control. It stifles you. It takes the oxygen out of it. And I wasn't thinking about myself as an artist. I was thinking about myself as a painter. And I truly didn't call myself an artist until about last year because I liked painter. Painter was like a trade. You know, painter was a skill. Painter was an act. Whereas artist, I sort of elevated it as you're a king.
You can call yourself an artist? What does it mean? How is it different from painter? Is it a bigger term?
It definitely coincided with finishing the book because I know that the book is also an artwork. That's why I call it a portrait in words, because I approached it very much as a visual artist, as a painter, someone who works with pigment, turning something abstract into something recognizable. So when I realized that I could be an artist in many different ways, not just with painting, I started to expand that definition. And when I really truly stopped painting, actually stopped painting for, how long did I go for? At the longest, 4 months. Not a single painting in 4 months. I mean, the depression that came with it was severe. Like I genuinely had to be medicated at that point. And that helped immensely because at that point I had just taken myself as far as I could on my own. And I'd only just started seeing a therapist. I actually started seeing a therapist the same day that I started my medication. And life is completely different now.
I'm so glad to hear that. What about painting and your body? Is that something, you know, are they able to be friends again yet?
I love that. I love how you phrase that. The answer, thankfully, is yes. I'm back to an almost regular painting schedule. I have this phenomenal personal trainer. Acoustic shockwave therapy, everyone. Look it up. That might help you if you have chronic pain. It took me a long time to find the things that actually made a difference. But at the base of that pyramid of recovery was rest and actually respecting myself, which I didn't know what that meant. I thought it was a luxury. I thought it was vanity, but it actually is a basic need. And it looks different for everyone, but for me, it's actually saying no sometimes. It's saying, I won't do that group show because I'm currently very slowly taking my time on a solo show. Very, very hard lesson to learn for someone like me.
You have been able to enter the Archibald again this year. Who did you paint?
I painted a portrait of the composer William Barton, who's an incredible Indigenous musician. And I met him last year and I painted this portrait of him. And it was such a transformative experience, which I totally didn't expect because it was the first ever time I created a painting without a brush.
Can you explain? What did you use?
So I put his music on. That was the first step. and my studio bounces sound in this wonderful way. And so I put his song, Birdsong at Dusk, and it just struck me completely, like squarely in the chest. It's such a beautiful piece. And I was holding the brush and I had the blank canvas and I physically threw the brush away and I dipped my hand into the paint and I just went for it. And I wasn't thinking. I was truly, truly in a state of flow. And at one point I caught myself and the tears were just running down my face. And Simon wasn't home, so I could be as batshit as I wanted to be. And I was like, I was talking to myself. I said, yes, you're doing it. You're actually doing it. And I was like coaching myself in this really wonderful, generous way. And I was talking to Will. I really went down the deep end. I was talking to Will. I was like, Will, this music is amazing. And I'm painting his portrait. And it was over 3 hours. And it was the greatest painting experience of my life.
Oh, Laura Bell, there have been so many interesting moves in this journey of yours already. I'm really excited to see what comes next. It's been great to have you on Conversations.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
This conversation was produced by Maggie Morris and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal, Yagara and Gadigal peoples. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.